All right, so this is the first class of 10 of my 10 fields of Zen. So this is a book that I'm almost done writing. I was done writing, and then during my sabbatical, I decided to replace a chapter and move some things around. So I'm not quite done. And I do hope to get it published at some point. But at this point, what you have access to is Google Docs, which reflect the most up-to-date versions of each chapter. They're also available on my podcast, the Zen Studies podcast, if you want to listen to them. They may not be exactly what the Google Docs are now, but that, you know, it's not that big a difference. So you can either listen to them or read them. So this first field, so I really want, I want these classes to be very practical in this series, as opposed to, you know, tonight's topic is bodhicitta, the mind that seeks the way. Bodhi is, you know, enlightenment, and citta is mind, enlightening mind. So I could give you a whole lecture, right, on the origin of the term and different texts that mention bodhicitta and all that kind of stuff, right? But this series is going to be less about like any of these topics academically and more about how we practice with them. And I'm hoping that in each time we will have, like tonight, small groups for part of it so that you can hear how other Sangha members, you know, practice in this particular field. And just in case, let's see, I guess a little bit of an intro. So the 10 fields, I won't be able to remember them all right now, but essentially I wanted to make it clear the breadth of practice, the way that practice can permeate your whole life. Many times people think practice is, you know, it's Zazen, it's Dharma study, it's coming to Sangha meetings. But really it is precepts and your ethical behavior in everyday life. It's your relationships. It's so one of the fields is opening the heart, opening your heart. One is bodhisattva activity. One is connecting with the ineffable. There's many different ways that our Zen practice can manifest. And I like the term fields. I've done elements and the, you know, ingredients and various things, but a field is like you move within a field. Right? You don't like finish a field. It's not a step. It's not a, you know, checkbox. It's just it's a, you know, so we can be exploring these fields for the rest of our practice. So the first field naturally is bodhicitta, or the mind that seeks the way. Bodhi is enlightenment. Citta is mind, the mind that seeks enlightenment, and I don't mean that in a small sense, but you know, that seeks the truth to awaken, and citta is mind. We say that this, if bodhicitta does not arise, then practice can't arise. This is our. And it doesn't, we're not talking about the first time you decided to practice Buddhism, right? Your way-seeking mind is something that may have consciously been with you since you can remember, or it may have been aroused by life circumstances. For instance, Dogen, he was very young, I think 8 years old, when his mother died, and he had already lost his father. So he became an orphan at a very young age, and he had said that when he was at her funeral and watching the incense smoke rise up, that he just really had a sense of impermanence, and that's what inspired him to seek to become a Buddhist monk. So many of us have different stories of how and when and where the thought occurred to us that there's got to be something more than has been evident so far. Or maybe it's a sense of questioning, of wanting to see deeper. So this is related to a term that I only encountered, I don't know, fairly recently. It wasn't one that I was trained with, because it's from Theravada Buddhism, and I don't even think it's widely used there. And it's the term is Samvega, and I do have a podcast episode on it. And this is a quote about Samvega by Ajahn Tanisaro, a Theravadan monk. He says, "It's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range. At least three clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. That's one. A chastening sense of our own complacency, and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. And three, an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle." This is a cluster of feelings that we've all experienced at one time or another in the process of growing up. But I don't know of a single English term that adequately covers all three. Such a term would be useful to have, and maybe that's reason enough for simply adopting the word Samvega into our language. So I think it's really helpful to be introduced to this concept and recognize that this is not the same thing as dukkha. Although I'm sure they could be happening at the same time, it may be hard to tell apart in some ways, but dukkha meaning a dissatisfaction about the way that things are, but it doesn't have quite the same, Samvega also has kind of a determination to find a different way. And also, I don't know. They could be related sometimes. Another example of this arising is in Shakyamuni Buddha's story, where he was a privileged young prince, rich young man, insulated from all difficulty, but nonetheless, a certain kind of, Samvega arose anyway, even though he had no external reasons for this to happen. And this is one of the reasons why, for myself, I was so amazed and grateful to encounter Zen, to encounter Buddhism, because I felt this and I didn't know what to do about it, and my life was I was very fortunate, never suffered any trauma. My parents loved me. I was well cared for. I was very much like Shakyamuni, really, right? So if the story of Shakyamuni had been about him suffering and experiencing great injustice and all that, and then, you know, forging through and finding a way, I kind of probably would have been like, well, I guess it's not really for people like me. But there it was. It was like Shakyamuni. There was no reason for his Samvega, and yet that arose. So I began to feel, when I encountered Buddhism, it was the first time, other than reading, there were authors who expressed what I was feeling, like Henry David Thoreau, for instance, is my first spiritual teacher, because I feel like this whole like chastening sense of our own complicity, complacency, and foolishness, and having let ourselves live so blindly, And so I hear, on the one hand, I'm reading this and he's saying, calling into question all of these ways that we live and why do we do this? And let's look more deeply at what really matters. But that was a book. And then I'm still surrounded by just life and what I was expected to do. And my Samvega was not met by anyone around. They just said, I don't know, like, well, but look at this good thing. Or, it's just something to be gotten rid of, to just don't stop feeling that way. Or at the very least, before you have encountered a possible way to deal with it, it just seems like something you're just going to have to live with, because here's the way life is. And so I had that feeling that once I really started on like, oh, okay, I graduate from high school, I go to college, I get the job, blah, 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 that I was just on a conveyor belt to death. I didn't see any point. Yeah. You'd have some fun along the way, but I'm like, what is it all for? What is the meaning? And people just thought I was crazy to even be asking that question. But when we encounter something that gives us hope, a way. So, right, like I did the reading, and I also read the Stoics in college, and, I read some things of like, okay, I like that. But then what? There was no place to go with that. So just like Shakyamuni, it said that when he was starting to feel this Samvega, one of the things that he encountered was a holy man, a renunciate religious practitioner who seemed very peaceful. And so that was one of the things, not only awakening to impermanence, but seeing that made him determined to leave behind his life and look for a way. And similarly, when I encountered Zen, I was reading a guidebook before I went on a trip to India, and it talked about the Four Noble Truths. And the First Noble Truth said, life is marked by dissatisfactoriness. They just say it. Like that's like the first premise. That's like, they're not trying, life is, you shouldn't feel dissatisfactory or anything like that. And then it's marked by dissatisfactoriness, and this is what you can do about that. So yeah. And then I got involved in practice, and it's not like, it's not like we instantly are completely happy and at peace, but the practice starts helping right away, right? And it just gives some context and meaning that we can start using it right away. It gives us some tools that we can use in our lives. So it becomes very clear that this is a path, and this is a path that I can work on this Samvega. So tonight we want to talk about, you know, when bodhicitta is a little sprout and how we take care of that, and when it gets bigger, how we nurture and cultivate it. But first of all, I did want to go into small groups for a little while. And that's so our Zoom host can, I'd say, do 3 to 4 in a group. Just so people have chance to share, because we'll just do this for like 8:23. Let's just do it for like 12 minutes once the groups have begun. And what I just invite each person to share something about your earliest stirrings of the way-seeking mind. Maybe not the earliest, but, you know, some early example of when you remember just really, really questioning, really doubting that the way that life was being presented to you was truly satisfying, wanting something deeper, curiosity, etc. So yeah, let's take that 12 minutes or so, and those in the Dirt Zendo can distribute yourself to the various corners for a few minutes to share.
Sorry for like hours.
That's fun.
All right, so the point of my field of Zen, including bodhicitta, is that I think it's important for us to identify, be aware of bodhicitta, and to be grateful for it. I mean, what is it that arises within us and wants to know the truth, that wants to be in touch with a greater reality? I like the Houston Smith quote that I've used many times. Like, just as the wing of a bird points to the reality of air, so our longing, you know, for some relationship to the divine points to that greater reality. So it arises within us, and we say, we cannot make that arise in anyone else. So this is something that's very helpful as we are dealing with other people in our lives. And we hope, not that we necessarily hope that they're going to be Buddhist or Zen, but we wish that they would, you know, they would start looking for a different way to be. And clearly they're suffering in the way that they are, but and they just won't. And we say, you know, just, I find that very helpful. You cannot make this arise in someone. I mean, obviously you can, maybe you can share something inspirational or whatever, but really it's going to arise when it arises. And there's really no use in filling somebody with all the things that they should do before that arises. And then once it arises in us, so all of us here have different, you know, we've been involved in practice of one sort or another for different amounts of time. But I think especially early on, our bodhicitta's like a tender little sprout, which can be easily crushed underfoot, sometimes by our own skepticism or our own self-criticism, sometimes by the skepticism of those around us. I think we're all very fortunate if we are, in relationships with people who are at least, happy for us. They're at least like, seems to be good for you. Go do it, even if they don't necessarily understand. But that's not always the case. Sometimes family members and partners are critical or skeptical or kind of jealous of our time and attention. So it can be tough to, protect and nurture that little sprout. But certainly being with Sangha helps, being with good Dharma friends helps, other people who have this kind of aspiration. And then, once our practice is underway, we may think that now bodhicitta isn't important anymore. That bodhicitta arose, got us to the path. Now we're good. But if any of you were here for Tyler's talk during Sangha Voices, he was talking about a kind of, I don't know, kind of a slow off period, I guess, where there's the inspiration for practice really wasn't as strong, just kind of going through the motions. And really, one way to describe that is, his little bodhicitta, I don't know, use a different metaphor. The flame of bodhicitta was kind of, dying down a little bit. So it really is something that we're responsible for maintaining and cultivating. We can't just rely on it, that it'll always be strong. And I think any of us who, have felt totally gung-ho about practice can end up feeling quite kind of confused and shocked when we find ourselves like, and that inspiration isn't there anymore. It actually can be, I don't know if terrifying is the right word, but because here's, practice has given us so much, and now we're like, so we can that kind of despair can come back. So how can we cultivate, enliven, nurture bodhicitta? I mean, there are many ways to do this, and we probably have a few minutes after I'm done talking that if you want to share some way that you have found to nurture your bodhicitta, you can let us know. For some people, or for some of us at some time, Dharma study can help. Really studying something that is not generally a contemporary text that just explains everything. Although maybe, I mean, whatever works for you. But sometimes more challenging, traditional texts that we realize that, especially something that we kind of like and we resonate with, but we don't get. And that can remind us that there is so much more to see and understand. We can turn toward what is unresolved in our life, deciding, that habit that I have, or that fear or something, I'm not just gonna just let that be. I want to understand that, and I want to see if there's some way that I can shift that. be liberated from that. Because it's easy to get complacent. I mean, unless, sometimes it's suffering that brings us to practice. And then when that suffering is alleviated a little bit, we're like, good enough. And it's important to think of this as this isn't about fixing ourselves. This is about fulfilling our I don't know what to say, our capacity, something like that. Fulfilling our possible the greatest possibilities that we have in our particular life and our particular body mind. I find attending session, our multiple day residential retreats, but other kinds of retreats too, like our continuous practice one coming up. But I find that to really enlivens my bodhicitta, that even before, if I'm going into it and I'm still like, oh, why am I doing this? I'm so busy and I don't want to take this time. And but then when I do it at some point, maybe right away, maybe a couple days in, where I'm like, oh yeah, okay, right. We can try to remind ourselves of impermanence. So there is a little prayer verses that many Buddhists say often on a daily basis. I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot escape old age. I am of the nature to have ill health. I cannot escape ill health. I am of the nature to die. I cannot escape dying. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. I cannot keep anything. I come here empty-handed and I go away empty-handed. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. So one of my personal vows, which is very ambitious and I've been working on for many years, but I feel like I'm making some progress, is to live each day as if it were my last. And that doesn't mean, right, like I'm not gonna work today, right? Like not kind of literally, but live with that attitude, that consciousness of impermanence and of just, the what I feel great regret about is when I spend time just caught up in wanting to get things done, irritated at anything that gets in my way. Just, I'm not even really awake and appreciating my life, which is ticking by, moment by moment, day after day. So I'm really, it's not, and that wasn't something that just through sheer force of will, right? Many years ago, when I kind of formed that vow, I didn't like, all right. I mean, I wanted to, just like, okay, from now on, not going to get irritated. But it just doesn't work that way. But somehow, just through practice and holding that helps inspire my bodhicitta when I'm starting to feel kind of complacent, because kind of call to mind that aspiration and I compare it to how I'm actually living. I'm like, oh, I want to be able to be, present to each thing that's happening. I mean, today I'm getting ready. I'm going to a the American Zen Teachers Association annual conference. Now we're outside of Houston, leaving tomorrow at like 4 a.m. and getting all kinds of stuff done before I go get a podcast episode out, prepare for class, pack, da, da, da. And, in the past, that has made for a pretty hectic couple of days where I'm pretty like just, I just kind of move and my dogs cower and my husband gets out of the way because I'm just, but I really, throughout this, I was still like, I don't know, I was still just present and kind of happy to be doing each thing. So, it pays off. Practice pays off. So yeah, that kind of vow, that kind of curiosity, seeking the company of good spiritual friends, it's something I'll be doing at this conference, getting inspired by other teachers and what they do and the things that they're working with. Challenging yourself in other kinds of ways too. Volunteering, learning something new, trying to be a better friend or parent or partner. There's no limit to your possible growth. And we can, this isn't exactly about cultivating bodhicitta, but we can try when our bodhicitta is strong to build up our practice as well as we can. So then we have a nice strong habit, which, I spent years as an ordained monk just kind of like, okay, I signed up for this. I'm going to Zazen. Now I'm going to study the Dharma. Now I'm going to, I mean, I my bodhicitta was, it was just kind of a sad desperation, really, more than anything else. But it was just like, well, this is what I do. This is what I do. I come to Sangha and I keep the precepts and I sit Zazen. And then, at some point it comes around again. And then we're so grateful that we didn't walk away from the practice. All right, so we have a few minutes. If anybody has any comments or questions or something you want to share, Nick.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit. Because you said towards the end that you talked about your aspirations in practice. Do we need aspirations for bodhicitta? Like, and if yes, the follow-up is like, how do we pick what to aspire to?
Well, I would say yes, you need aspirations, but this is really, you may not want to call it vow, but in Zen and Buddhism, we tend to call it vow. Forming an intention, whether it's private or public or whatever. And the learning how to make vows and keep them and relate to them is part of the practice. It is an art because we all know the process of like choosing an intention or an aspiration, which just like fails miserably and makes us feel awful because it's like it's part of us just trying to impose some idea on ourselves of how we should be. And then other parts of ourselves rebel. And it's just, or, now we have some ideal and we compare ourselves to it and we're just self-critical, or there's all kinds of unskillful ways to form and relate to aspiration or vow. So this is one of the things that they talk about a lot out at Great Vow Zen Monastery, where I often go to practice. That's and they have retreats on vow. And the way that they really describe it is particularly these, obviously you can make shorter vows. I'm going to vow to read the precepts every day for a while or something like that. But these deeper vows, they say it's really kind of a matter of uncovering them, discovering them. They're not something that you impose from the outside, but they're something that you look within and see what is it that you've been drawn to? What is it that you really, really like when you contemplate it, that fire of bodhicitta starts to, get more lively because that's what you really want. You really want to, like, I don't know, really want to be present for people who are suffering. You really want to, be a skillful teacher to children, or you can imagine how you could be. And that is what you want to be moving toward. Got a few minutes. Other things people have done to fire up their bodhicitta.
Hi, everybody.
Leah.
So I think that I'm sort of thinking there might be two ways to do this, like the positive way and the negative way. We could do this the easy way, or we could do this the tough way now. So because it seems like part, like some of it can be inspiring the flame of bodhisattva to burn a little higher when you suffer, or when you're going through some sort of trauma or crisis or shock. And then, but then isn't there like the positive side too? Like you could also have, it sounds really flaky and hippie-like, but silence in nature or just being in nature. Even if I'm having a time where it's like, I'm not thinking about practice. I got too much going on. I got all these other things of worries and distractions and whatever. But then, if I'm outside and I'm just are in the forest and it's quiet and I'm by myself and just the right, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm back. It's fine. It really does help and inspire me. And it's not a formal practice thing. It's more like a remembrance.
You are making me think about how my first field of Zen is bodhicitta. My last one is connecting with the ineffable. Ooh, we got a circle going on. It comes full circle. Oh, yeah. And yeah, definitely. I mean, where does this come from? It doesn't. This isn't a, you should practice Buddhism harder, right?
It's not a whip.
This is, like, yeah, sometimes we're driven to find a path because of suffering, but at other times, when I'm really able to let go, and I just listen to the sound of the music that I'm playing, and I let it play me. Oh my damn, there it is. Like it's Yeah, it's very inspiring. And it makes me want to know that mystery more. And our practice tells us that, it's not, this is what's beautiful about our practice is that it tells us, yes, at those moments, we are glimpsing something that is true. And we can have a relationship with that, a broader relationship with that. It doesn't depend on playing accordion all the time, right? It doesn't depend on you have to be out in nature, right? Those are places, ways that we might kind of naturally be able to access it, but it's not limited to that, which is lovely. All right, well, brings us to nine. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Hey, everybody.
Oh, Sabrina, nice.